Hello, everyone. My name's Ben. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Ben.
My brother's name is Jack. That's just going to work for him, okay? Anyways, my home group is a meeting in a movie, Al-Anon Family Group, every Friday at 6 o'clock here in Saskatoon. I am not there tonight, obviously. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak here tonight. It's an honor and a privilege to have been asked. I wish to thank Richard for asking me. And if Richard's around, how long should I be talking here? I had an hour, but we could pare it down if you like. 10, 15 minutes? Congratulations on holding the Saskatchewan Al-Anon Adult Children's Festival. I think it's a fantastic thing. I'm just amazed by how many people are here for the Friday night. Like, usually there's more on the Saturday than the Friday, so that's really, really encouraging. The first festival was in 1995 in Saskatoon, and there were about 100 people at that one, and that was the largest one there was. So this one may eclipse that. This is the 9th festival that's been held. So I think we've done a great job here in Saskatoon, adult children, having this. It's kind of eerie to be speaking on Friday the 13th, I have to say. I've decided that members in 12-step programs must be superstitious. Like, there's obviously, they stopped and they got to number 12, the steps, the traditions, the concepts. So there is a 13th step, but I'll talk about that later when I say how I met my wife and get into that a bit. Regardless, even though it's Friday the 13th, I'm sure things will go fine as long as I stay in the pentagram they've painted up here on the floor and don't go to that space. Before I get into my story, I want to say that we often do not seem to recognize the most significant moments in our lives when they're happening to us. Consequently, everything that I say is with the benefit of considerable hindsight. Also, if you've heard me speak before, I'm sorry, I just have one story, so it's the same thing. I try to modify it a bit as I deteriorate or whatever. But it's still the same story. I often wish I had been an alcoholic somewhere. Like, they have the most exciting stories. The material they have to work with, you know. They were drunk and they were at a red light and a police car stopped by them and they waved and they lost their license for years. You know, I just don't have that kind of stuff. But I'll do the best with what I have. One of the greatest realizations I have from being an Al-Anon is that alcoholism is a disease. It's recognized as such by the World Health Organization and the American Medical Association. No one is to blame, and I want to say that before I get into my talk much. I wasn't asked to speak on any particular topic tonight that I recall, so I'm going to talk on the theme of the festival, which is Journey to Serenity. What is serenity? Dictionary definitions of serenity. A disposition free from stress or emotion. The absence of mental stress or anxiety. The state or quality of being serene. Serene is defined as unaffected by disturbance, calm, and unruffled. After some consideration, I realized I'm not the guy to be here talking about serenity. I'm pretty tightly wound mostly all the time. But I've been on a long journey for several decades. And so I've definitely had a journey, and I am trying to get to serenity, so I guess I can talk about that. I'm also just going to throw in quotes from people about serenity during my talk and getting this a different perspective on it. Serenity is knowing that your worst shot is still pretty good. And that's by someone, Johnny Miller, American golfer. I was born a long time ago in the galaxy. It was Edmonton, Alberta, in the 1950s. And at that time, we had black and white television with one station when I was born. The milkman and the bread man came to the house in their trucks and brought stuff. And I was pretty sure in the back of the milk truck there'd be a cow and everything. Doctors made house calls. The mums stayed at home with the kids. And the men worked at their blue-collar jobs. which in Northeast Edmonton would be meatpacking plants, different industries. They worked at these jobs every day, and they drank every night. And that's what life was like in those neighborhoods. In my neighborhood, we lived in a townhouse, which now we call a condominium and cost 10 times as much. But there were 6 units all stuck together. And every one of the 6 units, alcohol was a problem. On one end was Lloyd and Betty. Lloyd was in AA in the 1960s, which was pretty progressive now that I look back on it. The next house over was Eric and his wife, and they had like 8-foot hedges around the house, and occasionally you'd hear screaming coming out, but that was about it. The next house over was Mike and his wife Sophie, and Sophie, friend of my mother, said that Mike was tired from work, so tired that he'd fall asleep in the back hallway. And my mother suggested that perhaps Mike had been out drinking. The next house over, Howard and Shirley, and one day we went over there New Year's Eve, and at 11 o'clock New Year's Eve, Howard was asleep. But we came, Howard was up ready to party, and he made something called giggle juice with 2 bottles of vodka and of some who knows what punch and ice cubes. And we giggled a lot till we started. But the guy had this ready to go, like just bang, it was ready, it was there. Then there was our perfect house. Then the next house over was Jim and Anna, and Jim had grown up in Germany during the Second World War. He was a teen then, and one night there was a great thunderstorm, and Jim was in the backyard just drunk out of his head, and he thought the Russians were coming, you know. So every one of those houses was a problem. In my house, my father drank, it's not for me to say he was an alcoholic, but he drank 6 days a week that I can recall from the 1960s to 1980. His father drank. His father's mother drank. I have 3 brothers and 1 sister, and all 3 of my brothers have had in their life problems with alcohol. One of them joined AA, another one stopped drinking, and the 3rd one still drinks. My sister and I, for some reason, we just didn't catch this. I have no doubt, though, that if I could drink without getting sick before I drank very much, then I'd be an alcoholic. No question whatsoever. When I was young, I was very much alive. I could feel things. I was attentive to the world around me. And this is young, toddler. I remember we took a trip together, and I was looking out the cabin window of our house. A cottage, rented cottages, and there were little cottages lined up. And I was looking out the window, single pane glass, and there were like bears climbing over the cottage next to us. So I didn't think much of this, because I was a city person. These are just bears. One of them, a little cub, came up to the window, stood on his hind legs, and looked at me. And I was looking at it, and we both pressed our noses against the glass, and we're just looking at each other. And I just realized we were the same. Like, he was in a bear body, and I was in a person body, and we're just both little cubs. So I realized there was some serenity, there was something bigger in the world then. And of course, I ended when I said, "Mommy, there's a bear looking at me." As the years passed, the effects of the disease of alcoholism grew in our family. And I have a few illustrative examples, and I won't get into them all, but I'll just touch on some of them, because they sort of highlight the evolution of the disease. We were having a family dinner, and I was very little, maybe 5, something like that. And my dad was home, and those kids that were born were sitting around. And my parents were talking fairly sharply to each other, and I just wasn't paying any attention at all. I was just playing with the spaghetti dinner. And suddenly my father picks up his plate of spaghetti and just flings it at the kitchen cupboards. And wow, that was a real wake-up call. Like, you got to pay attention to what's going on here with these people. Fast forward to when I'm in my teens, family dinner. Dad has had a car accident a few days before. Dad has been drinking as he has most nights, and he's sitting at the family dinner. And not that anybody dare point that out. Is Mom's a better driver because Mom doesn't have accidents than Dad. And I can see Dad is, you know, this isn't going down well with him. He's getting angry. So as a young teen, I say, but dad drives more than mom. And it was like cutting the wire on a bomb that was going to blow. It just diffused the whole thing. I fixed it. Little kids shouldn't be doing stuff like that. That's not what a child should be doing. A child should be free and playing, you know. So that's the evolution over several years in the family dynamics. The alcoholic home, the old analogy, it's like a mobile. People hanging from strings from pieces of wire. The alcoholic is always spinning, and all the other pieces are always adjusting their positions to keep the mobile in balance. And that's what I did. And that's what we all did in that home. I always come with lots of notes. I know some people, I always admire people who don't have notes. If you don't think I should have notes, that's why they have sponsors. You could talk to your sponsor about it. How was growing up in an alcoholic home for me? I was alone. I was really alone. I had 4 siblings, 2 parents. We had a dog at one point, but I was pretty much alone. I found companionship in fantasy. I played a lot of solitaire kinds of games. And I watched phenomenal amounts of television. Didn't need it. We eventually got more than one channel. Didn't need a TV guy. I knew it was on 24/7 on the TV. They could just ask me. I was afraid in that home. I was afraid of meeting people. I was afraid of my parents divorcing, of abandonment. I was afraid of ridicule, failure, my father. I was afraid of living life. When I was in my teens, I couldn't even take a bus downtown. I was afraid of crowds. I was afraid to go places. Somewhere growing up, I shut off feeling. Somewhere along the way, I withdrew into myself, and it was not safe to be myself. In my home, you could not be who you were. Serenity didn't exist. Numbing out existed. Children in alcoholic families play different roles, and this is all, you know, in many of the literature. There's the scapegoat, and who the eldest brother, the family clown, the second eldest brother, family hero, me, lost children, my younger siblings. So I was a family hero. How could I be a family hero? One thing that went right for me was schoolwork. I could do well at school. School, incredibly structured environment. The rules are laid out. There's an adult present to keep more or less things on track. You knew what you had to do to succeed. So I could work in this structured environment, following rules and pleasing the teachers. So I used to get good marks once upon a time. As a child, I loved to play, as I mentioned. I love to create and invent games. And different brothers at different ages, we would play games. And I would take several games, put them all together. So I'd take Monopoly, and we'd take a horse racing game with that, and a war game, and make some super game out of it. And I just loved doing that. It was a way of creative expression. So first with elder brothers and younger brother, we'd be doing that in the basement for endless hours. Wanted to have one illustrative example, one last grisly story from the good old days of what it was like, the family dynamics. I was 13 years old. I was helping my mother with the dishes. This is Edmonton in the winter, and you can't see out the kitchen windows, of course, because it's, you know, frost and frozen. But we see the headlights of the car pull into the driveway in the backyard. And my father doesn't seem to be in the house. And I'm a pretty smart alecky kind of person, more so then than now. And I say to my mother, what do you suppose he's doing out there? Making excuses, right, for being drunk and everything. Unfortunately, he had snuck into the house. And so he heard that. He was in the back hall, and drunk, and displeased. So he came into the kitchen, and he asked my mother, was that Benny talking that way about me? And my mother, one word, yes. Zip, that was it. So he came to me, he slapped me across the face, told me to go to bed. That's what I did. When I got upstairs, I discovered I had urinated my pants. That's how afraid I was of him at this point in my life. And what did I do after changing and cleaning up, of course? I did my homework. There were some siblings present in the room when I was young at that evening. Nobody ever talked about that ever again. Not my brothers or sisters or mother or father. Nobody. Nobody said boo. I have to say later that evening my mother did come to get me to go apologize to my father. But nobody discussed that. So that was the dynamics. Father loose cannon, mother unable to stand up for children, kids not allies, each of us hiding. It wasn't all horror living in the home. I mean, we had family vacations and birthdays and fun times and all of that. I had a friend in the late 80s, Cheryl was her name, and she told me that when she was a child in her alcoholic home, her father shot off guns in the basement. And he did that twice. And I said, but Cheryl, it's only twice. And she said to me, you just have to do that once, and people are on edge forever. So if you grow up in an alcoholic home where things happen every month or week or day, or you're always on edge. There's no settling down. What kind of serenity was there back then? Not much. I discovered some mechanisms for it, though. We had a pet dog, so I got to take the dog for walks. And that got me out of the house and made other dogs and pet owners. I also got into astronomy a bit, looking at the stars. And that was amazing, because I would go out and find constellations. I knew where the planets were when I was young. And to me, that brought me some kind of serenity. I was out of the house, in both instances, doing something with nature. In order to grow and mature, a child needs security and unconditional love. I did not get that in my alcoholic home, and most children do not get that living with active alcoholism. I don't... And my parents tried to be good parents. They just didn't know how. You know, they came from nutty homes themselves. They had no role models for them. My relationships with my siblings back then, we played and fought. We were like little lizards or something. Each of us had our own life, you know, separate from the others. My mother, interesting lady, was a war bride. My father was in the Canadian Army during this big war they had, like 6 years ago. So she was from Holland, and she wound up in Elk Island National Park in Edmonton with buffalo in the front yard. She came from Amsterdam. So she may as well have been taken to, you know, Venus or something. She's still in shock. She's never really recovered from that. My dad drank 5-6 days a week. Not on Sundays. On Sunday, he was a completely different person. He was funny. He did crossword puzzles, you know, just a relaxed, mellow kind of guy. But the other 6 days, he was nutty. For a lot of years, I wished he was dead. One day, he slipped on the ice in Edmonton. Seems to be a recurring theme here, the winters in Edmonton. So, and he cracked some ribs, and they were taking him out on the stretcher. He was on his way to work that morning. And I thought I hated this guy, but our eyes met as he was leaving, and I realized I loved him. And this came as a real shock. I must have been 15 or so. Like, I was really quite taken aback by that. So why talk about all this stuff now? Like, I'm obviously not 15 anymore, anywhere near those years. Why talk about the past now? I believe unless you come to terms with your past, you will forever be a prisoner of it. Unless you understand what makes you what you are, you cannot understand yourself. Another quote, an anonymous quote. Serenity is not freedom from the storm, but peace amid the storm. There's a lot of people who grew up in alcoholic homes. One third of all Al-Anon members had at least one alcoholic parent. And all Alateen members have at least one alcoholic parent. I have some survival skills I learned in my alcoholic home. Dishonest. I I'm a very good liar. I can craft lies beautifully if I don't choose. Manipulating people. Hypersensitivity. You know, focusing on someone, what are they thinking, what are they feeling. Not that I listen to what people say. It's more just reading their body language. And hiding from life. These are my tools for survival. I didn't know how to listen to my heart. I detested myself, the way I looked, my manners. And I didn't talk, I didn't trust, I didn't feel. These skills enabled me to survive until adulthood in that home. But they weren't very useful outside of that home afterwards. By age 18, I had zero self-esteem. I felt it was my fault the family was so sick. If only I had been a better child, done more chores, been smarter, whatever. Dad wouldn't have drank, stuff would have been smoother. At 18, I was forced to go on a journey of serenity. You have to leave home, you have to go to school somewhere else usually. Up to then, I think I was pretty much like in a cocoon or something. So that brings us to 1970. We'll eventually get to the modern era and finish the talk hopefully on time. In 1970, I started university at 18. And I went to university for one purpose, and that was to get a sense of self-esteem. I was going to be a medical doctor. I pretty much had my life planned. I was going to be a medical doctor, marry a nurse, have six kids, have tons of money. In 1972, before many of you were probably born, I was actually accepted into the medical school at the University of Alberta. A year later, I had failed medical school at the University of Alberta. I lived away from home, at a residence. It was nuts. I didn't know how to be social with people. And I really didn't have the aptitude or skills for what it took to pass back then. And I've come to learn a lot about myself since then, and I don't think it was the right thing for me at all. It was some idea that I had in my head since I was a little boy that I've been like some fantasy. I really knew nothing about it. So I failed lots of courses, biochemistry, I think I got 40%, and gross anatomy, 52%, and physiology, 40-something, and microbiology, I guess well on the multiple choice, I got 70%. But overall, I failed. And that was devastating at the time. I don't know why I didn't kill myself. I certainly thought about it. I went for some counseling instead. In 1973 counseling, nobody talked about alcoholism or alcoholic home or anything like that. It was all about me, nothing about what might have triggered that. Afterwards, I was sitting around the medical school where the students hung out. I still went there like a ghost for several more months. And there was an old janitor there, and he was talking to me, and I told him what happened. He told me, we don't understand God's plans, but they're always for the best. And I thought this was just the biggest load of crap. But it took me about 20 years to finally appreciate that as being wisdom. I then had to decide what to do in life. And I was, I like to think I'm pretty idealistic. So I don't care about money or possessions much. To me, the most precious thing in life are ideas, creativity, and imagination. I decided what I wanted. I had to decide what to do. And I didn't have any artistic background, but I had a lot of science background by that time. So I thought I'd go into science, do research in science. I'd also had a lot of summer jobs. I would, pack grocery bags, climb trees in the forest. I was a nursing orderly assistant or attendant or something. Worked in the lab making microscope slides. I was a desk clerk at the YMCA in Edmonton back in the Stone Age. Like just a bunch of jobs, enough to let me know I didn't want to be in any of these places for the rest of my life. I met people, those were their lives there, and I didn't want any of that. I wanted to do something that I would feel good about. There's a quote from Henry Longfellow, English poet, "The love of learning, the sequestered nooks, and all the sweet serenity of books." And that's what I wanted. I could find serenity in books. So I went to the University of Alberta, I finished a bachelor's degree, worked for all that while afterwards, decided to do a master's degree. So I went to the University of Regina where I did that. It was really, really tough. Only half the people started and finished those degrees. But I had nowhere else to go. So eventually I finished that. And I worked for a while, and what am I going to do next? I went to do another degree after I got a PhD in Guelph, Ontario. And I was really bad workaholic. That's all I did was work. 6 years, I would say. My life was the mall, home, the lab. That was it. I had very few relationships by that time in my life. I became obsessed with people. I fall in love as soon as I met them. It doesn't work, you know. I'm sure if I was dying, then their life would have flashed before my eyes, not my life. Not a good thing. So, 1986, I had gone to university to get a sense of self-esteem. Came out, didn't have it. 16 years later, one has to find that inside of oneself, not externally, but inside of oneself. And I didn't find it. In 1986, I moved to Baltimore, Maryland, and I was going to have a new life, a fresh start. I had a name tag that said faculty on it. Great picture, wearing a suit and everything. The new life didn't happen because I took Ben with me to Baltimore, Maryland. I was alone. I was afraid. My boss was an ogre. We picked each other. I had several places I could have gone, but I picked him. He was an outrageous control freak. I was still making the same mistakes in relationships, sabotaging them before anything happened. There seemed no way out, no options, no self-esteem, no joy, no hope, and definitely no serenity. Mercifully, in 1986, two great things happened. My sister sent me a magazine article about adult children. I think it was Chatelaine or something. I can't remember. I can still remember a fingernail ad right beside the column of text. But I read that thing, and it's like the fog was gone. I could see where I'd come from and where I was going. It was just perfectly clear. Suddenly things made sense. Also, within the same time frame, in the same weeks, I saw a poster at the university where I work, Noontime Serenity Al-Anon Family Group. Whether or not the alcoholic is still drinking, whether or not you live with the alcoholic, anonymity assured. I didn't go right away. I needed to be miserable for a couple more months. I won't go into all those details. But eventually, when I got thoroughly sick and tired of life, I went there. So my first Al-Anon meeting was in Baltimore, Maryland, in May of 1986. And I had a real hard time with it because I just couldn't understand this whole higher power thing. I want nothing to do with religion. And that's what I thought it was. But this is the only place I could go where people wouldn't judge me, where they accepted me for what I was and who I was. And they were happy to see me week after week. And it was Noontime Serenity. Every Wednesday at noon, that's where I went. And it just helped me make it through those weeks. I also discovered early on that I needed Al-Anon adult children meetings. I've been going to Al-Anon meetings since then, but my home groups, for the most part, not always, but for the most part, have been Al-Anon adult children meetings. And the only way I can explain it, alcoholics get better by working with other alcoholics, overeaters with other overeaters, adult children. I go to an adult children meeting, every sharing hits me. You know, it's not quite the same for me at a regular Al-Anon meeting, usually. So I need Al-Anon adult children meetings. I need to go where there's others with the same background and experiences. My higher power was in 1987, 1 year after being in Baltimore. I got a lifeline out of there. I got another position in St. Louis, Missouri, and I moved there. Much better boss, much better situation. I began to work harder at Al-Anon. I made sure I found a home group and went there. And I began to curtail my workaholism. I'd be in the lab at 10 o'clock Saturday night, and I'd phone would ring, and there'd be people from the program wondering what I was doing. You know, so they invite me out. We're having a movie at Kim's house, that kind of thing. So I would go to that instead. So I began to do other things in life besides work. I began to spend time with program friends. I was in St. Louis for 3 years, and I learned a lot about myself and the program while I was there. I learned about the steps. I learned about sponsorship. We also had real practical meetings there. I learned how to paddle a canoe. okay? We used to do stuff as a group. We went to play, had a park, we had a volleyball team. We do this between the meetings. Somebody's taught me how to drive a stick shift. I know I had never learned that when a friend of, at the meeting did that. I learned about a lot about myself during those years. I realized that I'm an addict in many ways. I was addicted to TV, to work, to food, to sex, to love, all these things. I used to tune up. Alcohol, I just can't do, but I there are other things I can use to escape from my life. I learned how to listen to my heart when I was in St. Louis, Missouri. These people helped to teach me how to feel again, and I began to have glimpses of serenity. I had a relationship with someone I met there in the meeting. Cheryl was her name. 1.5 years we were together. And it wasn't meant to be long-term. She'd been married a couple times before and had children and just didn't want that kind of commitment anymore. But I learned a lot. That was my first real relationship I was in. I came to understand a few things while I was there in St. Louis. I came to understand that whether or not I was happy or whether or not I felt joy was my choice every day. I could choose to be happy. I could choose to be miserable. I have choices. Do I choose to drink things with caffeine? Not good for me, but sometimes I do. Do I eat meat? Yes, unfortunately. Do I love my family, my brothers, my sisters? Not always. I have choices I can make every day. Secondly, I came to understand that wherever I am, there is energy, strength, and serenity flowing through everything. And all I have to do is sink down a little drill bit and tap into it. It's everywhere. I just have to look for it. I just have to be open for it. In 1990, I was looking for a job, and I got one here in town at the university. And that's where I've been ever since. So I teach and I do research. And in both of these, I've tried to follow my heart. I came back to Canada because I wanted to go home. I wanted to be close to home. And I wanted to be back out west where I was from. So anywhere, BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan would have been fine. And the joke of my life is that I teach in a medical school, and I failed medical school. I teach in a course that I didn't pass. Okay. Having said that, I teach anatomy, but it's not for the medical students, it's some other students. But this year, for reasons that we don't have half hour to explain, I had to give a couple lectures this last month, and I was really scared, that somehow they all knew they could see through me, but I didn't belong there. But I survived that. I find as I get older, and I'm not getting more cowardly, it's like you're walking a tightrope a lot, and I'm starting to look down more. And I'm not sure why that is. So, things scare me, but I still do them. And it's good to do them, because when you do them, you get stronger. Things frighten you, you can go through it, you can emerge the other end stronger. I teach, and I really enjoy my students. They're young, they're enthusiastic, they're bright, they're funny, and I really love being around them. I do research, too, at a small lab, and it's playing. It's putting games together and coming up with new ideas. It's the same thing. I really like that. My father died in 1996. Really, Al-Anon helped me with that enormously. I was able to make amends to him. I had hurt him in my life. I had moved away thousands of miles and saw him once every 2 years. And that really hurt him. And I had also said nasty things in my life to him when I was far away. Out of reach. I was able to tell him I loved him before he died. He told me one day, the last few years he was sort of losing it, he was sort of Alzheimer-like, but he told me that he wished he'd be able to spend more time with me when I was a kid, and that really meant a lot. He said he should have spent more time. His mother died, my father, his mother died when he was six. His father was an alcoholic. My father was a soldier 6 years, 1939 to 1945, before and after World War II. He worked in a meat packing plant for 30 years. He was smart and funny, but he was an alcoholic. It's hard to have hate for somebody like that, you know. How can you be angry with somebody like that? I've learned in Al-Anon that there's no sickness like hate. My relationship with my mother these days, she never really found Al-Anon. She went to a few meetings. Actually, my father also went. My father stopped drinking in 1980, 16 years before he died. But he went to AA once or twice, and he came back, and he wanted to know how to get in charge of the meetings. He just never went again, so he's kind of like a white-knuckle guy for a lot of years. My mother went to a few Al-Anon meetings, but she just didn't like it. It wasn't for her. But I make sure I see my mother, and I talk to her, and I phone her weekly, and try to be with her. My siblings, sister, I'm all of these relationships are in progress. So my brothers at various stages. Youngest brother, I'll try to see a football game with him every year. You know, just a bonding thing. My eldest brother had a 60th birthday. I'm just going to digress here. Recently, and I didn't want to go because my eldest brother still drinks. And he gets kind of, he tries to be funny, but he's not when he's drunk. Perhaps you can identify with that. So I didn't want to go to this thing. You know, it was in Calgary, in the Calgary Tower, and oh God, you know, I didn't want to be there. So I had to get a gift for him. And my wife and I are sitting, I'll get to her. We're sitting around at Midtown discussing a gift. And we had seen these John Wayne movies. And wow, this is great. Just pay the how many bucks it is and this will be fine. And she thought this wasn't great. She thought we should put a little more thought into this. So she wanted me to think of, like, tell me about him. What can you tell me about him? And what we wound up doing, my wife suggesting, was writing little vignettes or one-page stories about what he had meant to me as a child and done in my life, and putting these together in a little booklet for him. And there were 24 of them when I was done. It just took a couple hours to rattle these off. And I realized this guy had actually had a real positive impact in my life. You know, like the astronomy when I was a kid, he bought me the Star Book. You know, he used to take us for rides to get us out of an alcoholic home. Like lots of things he had done. So I went to Calgary and I was really looking forward to it. I didn't know. A quote from Mother Teresa: if you find serenity in happiness, some people may be jealous. Be happy anyway. Three things that I found in Al-Anon, or they found me, that have helped me on my journey to serenity. I'm just going to touch on three of them before we wrap up in another 6 or 7 hours here. One, people. Two, higher power. Three, service work. People. Number one, people. I've met everyone in Al-Anon. Every race, every age, pretty much every occupation. I haven't met any astronauts that I know of, but pretty much everything else. I have just a total cross-section of humanity. I've had some wonderful sponsors in Al-Anon. Award-winning kind of sponsors. One in St. Louis, one I had in Saskatoon. One in Saskatoon died several years ago. So I actually don't have a sponsor anymore, but I do have service sponsors, both service positions of a service sponsor. So I'm kind of using that guy as a sponsor. He doesn't know it though. I've had some wonderful sponsees. More so, I find, not that the people I sponsored here aren't wonderful, but there was more of it when I was in the States than there was here. So I haven't sponsored that many people. But sure learned a lot from anyone I have. And people have taught me everything. How to work the steps, how to perform service work, how to have fun, how to feel, how to love myself, and where to look for serenity. I've learned that from you. I was alone in Al-Anon. I haven't been alone since I started attending meetings. Higher power. Number two, higher power. At the beginning, I had a lot of trouble with spirituality and religion. But I had astronomy as a hobby as a child, and power greater than me, power greater than me. I had trouble with that because I didn't really believe there was a God or anything. So I realized that there are 100 billion stars in a galaxy, and there's 100 billion galaxies, so maybe there's a power greater than me. And thank you. You're trying to drug me, so I'll shut up. Thanks, John. Also, what is this higher power like? I remember sitting by the river in Saskatoon a few years ago, and I came to realize I'd never understand what higher power was like, where it was, what it looked like, how big it was. Like, kind of like a fly trying to figure out that jet that's going by. Like, not going to happen. I just don't have the gray matter for it. So I don't have to understand my higher power. I just have to believe in it. My conception evolved a bit. I did eventually start going to a place of worship, which I haven't been to much the last few years. But I am associated with that, and I that gives me some strength. Another quote, and this doesn't actually have serenity in it, but those who contemplate the beauty of earth find reserves of strength that will endure as long as life lasts. And that's Rachel Carson, a biologist from the 1900s. That's what it's interesting. We have dogs now. I take the dogs for a walk. Cranes. This time of year the cranes come through. I just love to watch these things. You know, just go by the river just south of town here. They're all over the place. Butterflies in the summertime. The carpets of butterflies just outside of Saskatoon. Many square meters of them. All looks like it's been painted with them. It's amazing to see that stuff. I decided I should find out more about dragonflies, actually, because they're really fascinating. So I started to get some books, but I don't know anything about them, and I'm hoping to learn more. And to me, this is a way of getting in touch with higher power, because higher power is in all of these things, just like it was in the bear, the cub when I was a kid. It's in all of these little things, too. Number three, service work. It's been my privilege to have been the custodian of many positions, service positions in Anima. And I say that because the person is not the group rep or the treasurer or whatever. You're like the custodian of that position, keeping it clean and intact for the next person. Part of working the 12th step is doing service work. It's a way to keep sane and growing in recovery. In order to keep it, you have to give it away. It's a way to serenity. There was this movie, A Christmas Carol. Okay, remember the old black and white one from the 50s, Alistair Sims, Scrooge, right? His partner Marley is a ghost, and he has all these things chained behind him, and he's dragging it along. And okay, Scrooge basically asks what Marley's up to. And Marley says he didn't walk among men in life, so now he had to do so in death. And that's why he was a ghost walking with all these things behind him. And I thought that would be me, pretty much. Because I never walked among people in my life. I never shared myself or was open. Al-Anon has helped me to do that. Service work. My first service work in Baltimore. I was asked to speak a couple of times. And somebody said, when you're asked to do something in the program, you do it. And that's why I did it. Otherwise, I would never speak. St. Louis, I chaired meetings there. That was about it. Until somebody said, it's your turn to be treasurer. And I said, I don't want to be treasurer. And they said, it's your turn. We've all been treasurer. It's your turn. So I was group treasurer. I really didn't want to do anything beyond the group. I could see, you know, cleaning up and making coffee and stuff like that. But I didn't want to do anything beyond that. In Saskatoon, I moved here in 1990, and several of us started a group, University Steps of Freedom. We did that way, way back. And we filled out all the positions, and somebody had to be group rep, and it was left over, and I took it because nobody else wanted it. And it's not something I really wanted to do. So I went to these goofy district meetings that I didn't know anything about, and they were talking a language I didn't understand, but I still went. And there were bad jokes, like, how can you tell the Al-Anon district meeting is which church? Well, it's the one with all the brooms in the parking lot. You know. that's how I felt back then. This is early 90s. But something did happen. In 1991, we had a provincial meeting in town here, an area assembly. And our district representative, I was a group rep, nominally, wanted us all to be there to help set up chairs. So I went, because anyone across or anyone to say we're good folks. Someone at the microphone, somebody who was a World Service delegate way back then, was saying that Al-Anon adult children did not need their own literature, that they could use regular Al-Anon literature and just think adult child. And that just made my blood boil. And for the first time in my life, I went to a microphone to object to this. And next thing I knew, another assembly was coming up, and by then I was supposed to be helping a workshop on writing Al-Anon adult children literature. And I had nothing to do with that. They just kind of slotted me into that. So I kind of got into it gradually and got hooked into it. I will be done in another 5 minutes or so, for those of you who watch this. I have had a service work journey, and I won't go into the grubby details of it all, but I have different phases. So the first years, 91 to 95, would have been like the radical, basically promoting adult children within Saskatchewan, Al-Anon. And way back when, in the early 90s, people didn't even think there should be adult children meetings, you know. So I found that by working with regular Al-Anon members, you know, going to the potlucks, helping setting up the chairs, doing all these chores and tasks together, that then they began to accept one as an equal and listen to what one was saying. The next period in service work, 96 to 99, was a fantastic time for me. For me, it was the creative years, you know, the innovative years. I was representing Saskatchewan. I got to go to the World Service Conference 3 times. And just amazing things. In Saskatchewan, we translated the 12 steps into 3 Aboriginal languages. At World Service Conference, Hope for Today came up. The adult child and daily reader is, do we want this or not? So I was able to speak for it. Lots of things. I won't go into it all. Then 2000 to 2004, the outcast. There was like the outlaw or something. It just didn't fit in anymore. It was an unhappy time, you know. I still went and did things, but it wasn't good. So, but since then, 2005 to now, I'm more detached, I think, with service work. I still do it. I'm currently I chair the provincial meetings that are held, 2 little ones and 2 big ones a year. I just wanted to see if I could chair a meeting with 200 people in it. That's all. That's why I took the job. Like, can I do this? It's kind of like, can I drive the the airplane here without crashing? And the answer is no. it's a humbling experience. A lot goes into chairing a meeting, you know, planning the agenda in advance, keeping things on time. And so far, my wish is to have left there without have screwed something up. So I have 2 more shots of it next year. So hopefully that'll happen. Another quote, it's Eckhart, a German mystic from around 1300. He who would be serene and pure needs but one thing, detachment. I met my wife in Al-Anon. We were members of the same online group, and we were sort of in the business meeting of that. And I didn't really know much about her, but I went to the 1998 International Al-Anon Conference in Salt Lake City, and she was there, and she wanted to meet a few people, and I was one of them. And it was just kind of bang, you know, love at first sight. I wasn't expecting it. I had no idea what she looked like or how old she was or anything. And it just happened. So I like to think that God had made this miracle person for me. You know, she was living in Toronto then, and it was just a perfect match, and nothing had ever seemed to work like that. So we got married in 1999. Right now we have a house, 2 border collies, 3 cats. It's difficult at times being married, but I think it's going well. I know that I'm if nothing else, a far better listener than I was 7 years ago. Also, I find comedians who joke about their marriages much funnier than I did as far as married. You know, there's one comedian I've heard referred to his wife as the control tower. Not that my wife is a controller, but I can identify. somebody else, you know, just walk into a room where your wife isn't standing there, and within 1 minute she'll be telling you what to do. It works. It really works. I've been a bachelor for about 30 years as an adult, and for the last 10 years before marriage I chose to live alone because I didn't want any more of those pesky roommates or housemates, you know, lack of privacy, having to live with other people's idiosyncrasies. So to be married, huge, huge shift. An example, my father-in-law came for Thanksgiving dinner this last weekend. He phones us Saturday. By the way, I'm coming over. He lives in Prince Edward Island, but he's in Edmonton, and now he's 5 hours notice. Okay, we got a miter saw and a sewing machine in the front, in the living room. And the bathroom looks like it's been, you know, some kind of mold experiment or something. And we're supposed to get ready for this, and my wife starts with, "You've got peanut butter in the jam. I'm going through these medical receipts. You were supposed to mail this 2 months ago." And just on and on and on and on. And I know what's going on. So I'm able to say to her, I realize that you're anxious because your father's coming and we're not ready, but you know, try not to be angry with me. And it just toned her down because she understands that. So Al-Anon has helped me a lot in dealing with this kind of thing. I can say though that being married, being in a long-term intimate relationship, is the most difficult yet most rewarding thing I've ever done. It's the most difficult thing though of all the things I've spoken about tonight. Serenity remains difficult for me. I was down by the river today with the dogs, and there were some beautiful things there. The cranes are there again. Nobody was there, mainly just, you know, during the daytime. I was walking through this wooded area, and these chickadees were just like inches from me. I can't remember them being that close. I didn't have any food or anything to give them, but it's just, to me, that's very spiritual. The dogs were having a great time. But, on the other hand, going into this area, which is like a point looking out over the river, somebody has thrown an old couch. And it had to drive like half a mile to get there, but they dumped an old couch there. And it's making me angry. Like, I want to, maybe we can dust for DNA or something and figure out who did this. And then somebody else I hear somebody else say that their dog was, you know, a porcupine hit their dog, and just where I had been like 20 minutes before. So I have these serene, beautiful things, yet this insanity, and I have to somehow detach from this insanity. Like, just leave that couch there. I don't have to rent a van and take it away. You know, just, it's a choice what I need to do. Just like choosing to be happy, I can choose to be serene or not. I'll just close with a quote from Survival to Recovery, which is Al-Anon's children book. "If I can accept life on life's terms, it becomes much more manageable. Like a river, life moves on, whether I agree to it or not. I can choose to ride the river as it flows. I can paddle upstream. I can float downstream. I'm not in charge of the river, but I do have choices. I feel more peace, joy, and relaxation today. I call that serenity." I won't be here for the entire weekend. But I'll come back tomorrow for the banquet, and maybe a bit before that. Because as I mentioned, I have a wife, two dogs, and three cats. I've got stuff to do. But I'm really looking forward to what I will see here and to talking to many of you. I thank you for asking me to speak, and hope that each of you will have an enlightening and joyful, but above all, serene festival. Thank you.